Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, in most parts of the world, inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. It's what some call the Great Convergence. Then on the Scholar Circle, what will be the hallmarks of a post-Chavez Venezuela, domestically and internationally? The world is witnessing what our next guest calls a Great Convergence. That is, that inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. Joining us in studio is Kishore Mahbubani. He is the dean of the Lee Kua Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore and the former ambassador to the United Nations for Singapore. His book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Kishore Mahbubani, it's great to have you here with us. Let's start with your basic concept that what we're seeing is this convergence of almost like a global society. You think that's a really good thing. For example, economically, we're seeing far less poverty. What are the numbers? How's it manifested?
Well, I think one of the best kept secrets in the world is that the last 20 or 30 years have been among the best 20 or 30 years for the vast majority of the world's population, because their lives are improving on so many counts. Firstly, wars are becoming a sunset industry. In the 1950s, 500,000 people a year would die from wars. Now it's less than 30,000. That's a dramatic decrease. Secondly, global poverty is disappearing. One of the few Millennium Development Goals that we will meet is the halving of global poverty by 2015. And the US National Intelligence Council, a relatively conservative body, has predicted that global poverty will be eliminated completely by 2030.
How are they defining global poverty?
The United Nations has a technical definition. I'm not sure whether it's $1 or $1.25 a day.
So but it's still kind of a low figure.
Yeah, but that's amazing. Hundreds of millions of people have been liberated from absolute poverty. But thirdly, and this is the most stunning thing, the number of people joining middle classes in the world is exploding. And just to take Asia alone, right now, the number of people who enjoy middle-class living standards in Asia are roughly about 500 million people, which is a large number, you know, still bigger than the population of the United States of America. But that number in 7 years, by 2020, is going to explode to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. This is a massive upliftment of humanity that we've never experienced before. And that's why I call it the Great Convergence.
A couple of numbers from your book. There are still 2.5 billion people out of seven who don't have access to even a toilet, and even more who are without clean cooking facilities. Mm. So we do still have a very large chunk of people who don't have the fundamental basics.
By the way, when I grew up as a child in Singapore, we didn't have a flush toilet in our house. The per capita income was the same as Ghana, and I was put in a special feeding program when I was young. Now, I mentioned that because Singapore was a typical third world state. Now, Singapore's per capita income is higher than that of the United Kingdom. And we're doing much better than UK in many ways. So the fact that Singapore could go from a typical third world developing country to becoming a modern first world developed country in my lifetime is amazing. But now that feat is being repeated many times over all over Asia.
There's some other sections of your book, when you put them together, bring up a paradox. And that is the more people that we bring into the middle class, and having 7 billion people on the planet, the more we have a sustainability problem. Can the planet Earth sustain 7 billion people who have all of the comforts of middle class? How do we deal with this?
Clearly, that's a huge challenge. And I think we have to think about it now because, you know, more and more people in the world will want to have electricity in their homes, television sets, cars. And so clearly energy consumption will go up, global greenhouse gas emissions will go up, and we need to do something about it. But the only way to do something about it is to find an equitable mathematical formula. And as the Prime Minister of India says, and I think I quote him in my book, he says, you can't expect me to deprive 400 million Indians of electricity just so that Americans can keep on driving their SUVs. So come on, if America is the richest country, doesn't take the lead in promoting the notion of sacrifice, how can you expect the poorer countries to make a sacrifice? And that's exactly why Copenhagen broke down some years ago, because sadly, President Obama was calling on the poorer countries to make a compromise, but the United States Congress had tied his hands and refused to give him any room for negotiation.
There are voices in the American public sphere that argue the exact opposite. And it's part of what you talk about in this book, The Great Convergence, where we are all thinking about our own state issues and not thinking as a global community. And you point out that three former heads of state have addressed this issue and talked about the global community and how we need to look at these things as a planet, not as individual states. Mm. And yet while they're heads of state, they can't do it.
Yes. In fact, I begin the book with a very simple metaphor to explain how the world has changed. I say that before, when 7 billion people lived in 193 separate countries, it was like they were living in 193 separate boats with captains and crews taking care of each boat and rules to make sure the boats didn't collide. That was the pre-globalization world. But today, with the world having shrunk, the 7 billion people no longer live in 193 separate boats. They live in 193 separate cabins on the same boat. But you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin, but no captain or crew taking care of the global boat as a whole. And that explains all the problems we are having in terms of global financial crisis, in terms of global warming, in terms of pandemics and global terrorism and so on and so forth. So that's why I quote Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Al Gore, all of whom said, hey, we're now living on the same boat. We must now come together. But as you mentioned earlier, the paradox is that what seems so obvious to them, after they left office, they couldn't say while they were in office. And that's the tragedy of democratic politics.
Now, part of your argument is what we're missing is a one-world theory, really a theory that leaders can sell to their electorate that would allow them to then participate in these global agreements. What might one look like?
The good news for us is that the world as a whole is becoming a better and better place. More peaceful, less poverty, more prosperous. So the global trends are going in the right direction. So it makes it easier for us to come together and cooperate. Now, frankly, China and India have actually announced they're prepared to make some sacrifices in their development to prevent global warming. Now, that's a remarkable concession from relatively poor countries. So if you can get the richer countries to do the same, and to be fair, the Europeans are doing it. It's only the United States of America where it is impossible politically for the U.S. Congress to make any kind of concessions to reduce global warming. That's why the heart of the problem lies here in the United States.
It's also another paradox. You wrote about this in your book, The Great Convergence, where here, the United States has been the home of a very robust environmental movement. And yet here it is China that is acknowledging climate change and prepared to do something about it. How do we explain this?
You're right. This is a major paradox. And I say somewhat mischievously in the book that perhaps Al Gore, as a symbolic gesture, should announce that he has to return the Nobel Peace Prize because he has failed in his mission of trying to persuade the American public and the American government to make sacrifices to take care of global warming.
You said that China is also developing a vast NGO network that has never been in existence before, and many of these are environmental organizations. What is the impact of this? And is this something that has arisen from the Great Convergence?
China has gone through many dramatic transformations. I mean, when I went to China for the first time in 1980, China was a completely regimented society. There were no skyscrapers in the cities, no billboards, no cars. People were just driving bicycles and people wore Maoist suits. It went from a very tightly regimented society in 1980 to a society that when you go down there, looks as open as America in many ways. When you go to the universities, you can discuss anything you want. And amazingly enough, you have various NGOs that have come up that are now quite critical of many of the government's policies. And in fact, the one new political reality that the Chinese Communist Party has to deal with is NGOs who are watching their policies and saying, hey, you're destroying the environment. We have to do something about it.
Another aspect that you mentioned was that a media is starting to develop that is challenging the government at various times. The example you gave in the book was a train crash. In the past, the government might have been able to push it under the covers, but that didn't occur. What happened?
Well, I think in this major train crash, the government tried to go back to its old impulses, which is to pretend that no major disaster had happened. And they almost literally, not metaphorically, tried to bury the evidence. And there was a huge outcry, public outcry, and the government had to stop doing so. Remember, many years, many decades ago, when China had a major earthquake, when Chairman Mao Zedong announced there would be no publicity about the earthquake, the government had to comply. So an entire earthquake was not reported in China. Today, when one train gets involved in a crash, the whole country gets to know about it. That's how China has opened up.
Now, is this also a result of the great convergence you write about because of the technological advances that are occurring?
Yes. In fact, the number one language that is used on the internet today is not English, but is Mandarin. Because there are more Chinese internet websites than there are English-speaking websites. So it has become, in that sense, a much more open society. I must emphasize, the government does try to block information flows, cut information flows, but it's very difficult in the world of today.
It seems that this global community that's starting to emerge, as opposed to disparate groups, disparate states, is primarily a result of information and the technology, peer-to-peer media, as well as international media that are allowing people to learn about each other and about different societies and call together perhaps the most eclectic best practices.
In my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere, I tried to explain why the Asian societies, which have been dormant for two centuries or so, why have they suddenly sprung back to life? And I say the reason why they did so is that they were finally understood, absorbed, and are implementing pillars of Western wisdom, including mastery of science and technology, a culture of pragmatism, meritocracy, a culture of peace, rule of law, and of course, education. But in this new book, I push the argument a bit further. And I say there's a new consensual cluster of norms are emerging in the world, and that results in these countries succeeding and developing. And one of them, for example, is the spread of reason and logic. Governments today, in most places, are beginning to understand how to develop societies. And to give you a simple example, like encouraging people to wash their hands improves hygiene dramatically. And guess what? It leads to less babies dying. So it's simple best practices that are now spreading all over the world and are saving millions of lives.
Is there also a downside? I wonder about the spreading of norms that might not be so productive, the spreading of corrupt practices, for example. Mm-hmm. And this ties back into the idea that in some places we're seeing, as you've noted, that the very poor people are rising and joining the middle class. Whereas in other places like the U.S., the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and corruption in some cases being rewarded or at least forgiven in very public ways.
Yeah. I must emphasize that I don't claim that the world has reached nirvana yet. I mean, global poverty will not be eliminated in the next 2-3 years. It will be eliminated by 2030. But to look at the world through the eyes of the majority of the world's population, especially the 88% of the world's population that lives outside the West. Now, the population who live in the West have had a bad decade. Since 2008, 2009 financial crisis, things have been very difficult in Europe, things have been very difficult in America. But from the point of view of the majority of the world's population, the 3.5 billion who live in Asia, a billion who live in Africa, the 500 over million who live in Latin America, the last two decades have been wonderful. 6 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the past decade have come from Africa. There have been dramatic improvements. Just to give you one statistic, in 1990, there were 0 cell phones in India. 0. But by 2012, that number had grown to 750 million in 2 decades. Now, that's a remarkable achievement. And a cell phone, by the way, is not just something that is used for bilateral conversations. It also connects people to the modern world, gives them access to information that they couldn't have before. All these little things have improved their lives dramatically.
You noted Africa. It seems when you look at it through the eyes of mass media that Africa is actually suffering quite a bit, particularly with all of the political violence. Can we really say that things are better in Africa?
Well, if you ask the Africans, they will tell you that things are getting much better in Africa. Our views on the world are conditioned by what we see on television. So we see the violence in Syria, we see the violence in Mali, we see the problems in Sudan, we say, oh, the world is falling apart. But statistically, the number of people who are experiencing violence, especially interstate conflict, is the lowest it has ever been.
Do you think that the emphasis from the statistics is that it's interstate conflict, meaning state versus state, versus the internal conflict? The internal conflict seemed pretty awful.
Most people believe that while people dying from interstate conflict is going down, people dying from intrastate conflicts are going up. And that's not true either. Again, the data is very clear. Of course, there are some countries where conflicts carry on. I mean, this is a fact. Afghanistan is clearly still at war. Somalia still has conflict. Of course, there are problem cases. But, you know, you don't judge the health of a population at large by looking at the people with the worst health. You look at the average throughout the society and the average levels of violence in every dimension, interstate, intrastate, and even domestic violence is going down.
You mentioned also that education is on the rise in these parts of the world.
One of the best things that's happening in the world today is the spread of modern education. And as you know, that's also liberating women. Some of the most stunning statistics I provide come from Iran, where 65% of undergraduate enrollment in Iran is by women in the science area. So much so that the Iranian government had to cut down the number of females going to universities because they were shocked at the number going up. So you can see all over the world, education is spreading. And in look at China, as recently as 1993, only 5% of each cohort went to university. Now that number has grown to 23%. Again, that's in 20 years. The world at large is becoming better and better educated. And that's one of the reasons why the world is becoming more peaceful. That's also another reason why the world is becoming more healthy.
Now, do you see in this convergence that while the rest of the world is coming up, that the United States might be dipping?
Both the United States and EU, as you know, are going through a rough time. The developed world, even if you slide backwards, your quality of life is still much better than that of most people in the developing world. Now, America has got some unique problems now. One of them clearly is rising inequality. That's a challenge it has to deal with. The other challenge which has come as a shock to the whole world is the political paralysis in America. And when you watch the debate over sequestration, the incapacity to pass budgets, believe me, this has really shocked the rest of the world. Because in the past, they assume that if they wanted to look for a role model of a democracy that they should copy and emulate, they assumed that America had the best democracy in the world. Today, watching what is going on down here, I can tell you very few countries want to copy American democracy. Their view is something has gone wrong here. We must make sure we do not do what Americans are doing.
I want to go back to a couple of things. One is, again, the information technology, and the other is the issue of the spreading of ethics. I think they fit together. You talked about that one of the important norms was the rule of law. Most people would agree that the rule of law is a very important thing, except for, of course, when the rule of law is very unjust, which we have seen periodically throughout societies, particularly in discriminatory societies, or when they support things like slavery or discrimination.
What I mean by the rule of law, see, Americans take it for granted. I mean, America has one of the best rule of law conditions of any society anywhere in the world, frankly. But the rest of the world has got a long way to catch up in this area. But the good news is that they are moving in the right direction. Because in the past, especially if you live, let's say, in the Arab world, you took it for granted that the rulers had a right to rule and you had to be governed and accept their rules. But as you know, the Arab Spring demonstrated that four rulers who have been ruling for over 150 years, Mubarak, Ben Ali, Gaddafi, the president of Yemen, suddenly disappeared within a year. Why? Because people no longer accept rule by law. They want rule of law. The difference between rule by law and rule by law means the ruler decides and you obey. Rule of law means that there are laws in which not just the people have to comply with, but the rulers have to comply with, which is why Mubarak is in jail. So he too now has to comply with the rule of law. And that's a dramatic revolution. And by the way, this is something that China hasn't achieved yet. Because in China, you still have, in many cases, rule by law, because the Chinese Communist Party still remains above the rule of law. And that's going to be China's biggest challenge. The Chinese Communist Party also have it comply with the same rule of law as the people. And that will take a decade or two, but that's something they have to do.
Where else do you see that as a problem?
If you take a country like Indonesia, which, by the way, is a large country, 240 million people, the fourth most populous country. For a long time, when President Suharto was running it, you had rule by law. He and his family were above the law. But today, the president of Indonesia is not above the law. There's a free media, there's an independent courts, and very powerful people, including the chairman of the ruling party of the president, and now have to go to court to defend themselves. These are remarkable developments. And even in Pakistan, which, as you know, people believe might become a failed state, the Chief Justice could sack a president. Now, that's a remarkable step forward.
The other paradox that you also point out is while the U.S. has this rule of law domestically, we have problems with the rule of law internationally. Hmm. And, of course, again, the book being called The Great Convergence, thinking in terms of a global society rather than as individual disparate states. Hmm. How does that fare with what's happening as a global society?
The tragedy here is that the United States, as I said earlier, has got the best rule of law at home. And yet the United States has become one of the greatest violators of international law. I mean, conducting a war illegally in Iraq, as Kofi Annan said, and not ratifying treaties and conventions like the Law of the Sea Convention, virtually every other state had ratified. And this is something that Americans have got to wake up to and realize that this is no longer in America's national interest to do so, which is why I begin the book by quoting from a speech that President Bill Clinton gave in Yale in 2003, where he said, if America assumes it'll be number one forever, then fine. We should carry on doing what we're doing. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. But if we can conceive of the possibility that we'll no longer be number one, surely it's in America's interest to create a rules-based order that will constrain the next number one. He didn't mention names, but obviously he's talking about China. So if you want China to emerge as a law-abiding, rules-based superpower, then America should show the way, and America should lead the way by complying with international law.
If we are all converging, and if we are becoming a global community, how do we start to function as a global community, which some people might not like, by the way?
The world, to use another metaphor, the one that Kofi Annan uses, is also becoming a global village. And if you live in a village, as you know, you must have a village council to mediate in disputes, to pick up the garbage, to ensure that the street lights come on, and so on and so forth. In the same way, as we are becoming a global village, we need to also have stronger global village councils. If you start creating them from scratch, it's a mission impossible. It's almost impossible to start new organizations. But the good news is that you have organizations like the United Nations, which were inspired by American ideals, produced by American statesmen, as you know, at the end of World War II. So the United Nations is essentially an American creation, which many Americans have forgotten. So why not try to strengthen and revive the United Nations and its sister organizations? If you live in a global village and if you're worried about a global pandemic, then what you should do right now is strengthen the World Health Organization. But sadly, it has been American national policy to weaken the United Nations and to weaken World Health Organization, to weaken the International Atomic Energy Agency. And what I say is that in this new world, it is time for the United States State Department to switch off its autopilot mechanism and review its old policies and now work on strengthening rather than weakening multilateral organizations.
And it sounds like to perhaps even stop dominating them.
The United States will always be powerful. Even if it becomes number two, it will remain one of the most powerful countries in the world. Given its sheer power, it will continue to dominate the world in one way or another. But what the United States can do now is to use its strength and its dominance to create a more cooperative world order, which will be more comfortable both for the United States and for other countries in the world. I'm not appealing to American idealism, to American altruism. I'm appealing to American self-interest to say, hey, it is now in your self-interest to strengthen these organizations.
There were a few aspects of these international organizations and the United States engagement that you pointed out. I think you call them barriers to convergence. The OECD, Afghanistan, the IMF, and the corrupt aid process. Perhaps you can give us a little thumbnail sketch of each of these and how you see them as barriers to this global community.
Yeah. One of the most ironic barriers to convergence is the belief in the West that the Western nations are the most generous nations in the world, and they believe they are the most generous because they give a lot of foreign aid to the rest of the world. And I think very few Americans know that even by OECD standards, America is one of the least generous nations among the OECD in terms of percentage of GNP that it gives out. And for every dollar that the United States gives out, 80 cents comes back to the United States and 20 cents goes to the recipient. So this is why I say, ironically, at a time when America is facing huge budgetary problems, many thoughtful, well-intentioned Americans may want to preserve America's foreign aid budget because they want to help the rest of the world. Actually, if America stops giving foreign aid, the world will not even notice it because it has very little impact on the rest of the world.
But some countries would notice it.
The two countries, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that receive the most amount of U.S. foreign aid are Israel and Egypt. And the rest of the world receives very little. And believe me, today, countries have finding other ways and means of developing. And much of American foreign aid, actually, and this has been documented by many authors, has a distorting effect on countries. And it actually doesn't help the country's development. So to use an old mantra, trade, not aid, is the answer.
You talked a bit about the geopolitical issues and some of the other clashes that are creating problems in our global village. One of them was the West and Islam. How do you see that being resolved?
Most people, when they read my book, think I'm a woolly-headed idealist. Actually, I've represented a very tough, realistic, pragmatic country like Singapore for 33 years. So I'm a hard-headed international realist. And I actually recognize that there are geopolitical challenges in the world that have to be overcome. But the good news I have is that they can all be overcome. And certainly in the case of Islam in the West, I see no necessary reason why there should be any kind of clash of civilizations, because most Muslim societies are modernizing and opening up themselves. I also suggest that there is a simple silver bullet that is available to reduce the tension between Islam and West, and that is, of course, a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. It is in America's interest, in Israel's interest, in the interest of the Palestinians to work towards a two-state solution, and the best time to do it is now, and that will lead to also a reduction in tension between Islam and the West. The politics on this in America are very complicated. In fact, my friends have told me, be very careful when you speak about the Israeli lobby in America, because it's very easy to be misunderstood on this subject, which is why I emphasize that I'm a friend of Israel. And in fact, I actually serve at the United Nations as a fellow ambassador together with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. And so as a friend of Israel, I'm arguing, this is the time for you to make peace now.
We've been speaking with Kishra Mahbubani. It's called The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Thank you so much. When we come back, what will be the hallmarks of a post-Chavez Venezuela, domestically and internationally? Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Venezuela is once again at a crossroads, now with the death of their charismatic leader, Hugo Chavez, who changed the direction of the country. What does the legacy of Chavez mean for Venezuela's present and future? Three experts join us. Daniel Levine is with us. He is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Michigan and the author of The Quality of Democracy in Latin America and Constructing Culture and Power in Latin America. Jennifer McCoy also joins us. She is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Carter Center's Americas Program at Georgia State University. She is the author of International Mediation in Venezuela and editor and contributor to The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela. David Smildy is also with us. He is professor of sociology at the University of Georgia and co-editor of Participation, Politics, and Culture in Venezuelans' Bolivarian Democracy and co-author of Reason to Believe, Cultural Agency in Latin American Evangelicalism. Thank you for being with us. I want to start with a historic context that gives us an idea for today's Venezuela, which seems very polarized. David Smildy, as you've studied the movements that have brought us to the current situation, what historic context do you think we need to know to understand this?
Well, I think to understand the current context, and especially polarization, I think you need to understand the 15 years before Chavez, in which from 1983 through 1997, there was a really dramatic increase in social polarization. Poverty doubled, inequality doubled. There was a real deterioration in the lives of a lot of average Venezuelans. Chavez is elected in 1998 at the end of a cycle of real deterioration of Venezuela's electoral democracy, especially in terms of the political parties. And in 1998, he's elected, comes on with a program or a platform of participatory democracy, and pushes through a new constitution, and during these first couple of years has a really very high level of popularity. At the end of 2001, beginning of 2002, things really start to deteriorate in the sense that Chavez then starts to move towards trying to push social and economic democracy and really try to change the economy. And that's when the real polarization begins. Since then, in Venezuela, both sides have not wanted to recognize the other side and their legitimacy. And so both sides really see themselves as fighting for their lives. And that leads to a real process of a polarization. Now, Chavez, of course, as everybody knows, passed away almost 2 weeks ago now. And that puts Nicolas Maduro in position to become the next president. It looks like he will be elected. He currently has about a 15-point advantage in the polls. But this polarization process still continues, even in the perception of what Chavez's death means.
Jennifer McCoy, what else do you think we need to understand?
I think that what we see in Venezuela, we've also seen in some other Latin American countries. In cases where there is deep inequality, especially income inequality, but also it can be gaps and discrimination against groups of people, such as indigenous people. When you combine the level of grievances of people who have felt ignored or excluded for a long time with the right to vote, then we see a real demand for change. And in countries where the institutions aren't strong enough, if the political parties and the governments aren't strong enough to manage that change, then you can go in unpredictable directions. So in the Venezuelan case, the political parties who had been very strong in the 1970s and 80s became discredited in the 1990s as people were sliding into poverty, oil prices were down. And so people voted for change and for radical change without a clear knowledge or guide of where Hugo Chavez, whom they voted for, in 1998 would go.
Daniel Levine.
Two things. First, it's certainly true that the situation is very polarized. One thing to note is that the whole political system that Chavez replaced was one which tried to mute polarization, and then after a while it became impossible to mute the polarization because of the elements that David indicated. The second thing I would add is that the Chavez, as a movement and in power, has deliberately accentuated polarization in his rhetoric, in his public mobilizations. It's been a government which has thrived on mobilization, mass mobilization, and polarization. So in terms of purely political polarization, I think it's increased. I also think it's likely to increase in the future, but purely political polarization has definitely been a strategy of this regime and government and will probably continue to be one in the future, if Maduro wins, as David says, so it's likely, and I imagine it is likely.
It strikes me that there's a very black and white thinking that has emerged with Hugo Chavez, sort of a good guys versus bad guys, that has really resonated with people. Would you say that was part of the construction of power?
For Chavez, absolutely. I think the way to understand Chavez is he is the product, partly the product of the decay of the previous system. He didn't cause the decay of the previous system. The previous system had many problems, as everyone knows, and as David and Jennifer have pointed out. But he's sort of the product of that and of the discredit of that. His whole original campaign was, I am not them. And he called for a refounding of the republic and a political strategy which has been imitated in other countries, calling for a new constitution, for redefining the basis of the nation. And he has been very active in an us-them kind of rhetoric. He was active throughout his career, and that has continued with Maduro, who has used many of the same phrases and rhetoric that Chavez himself used.
This is Jennifer McCoy. I think also when we see in a country really deep grievances that people can and often do vote for a strong leader, and we've seen this, for example, with security fears in Colombia voting for Uribe when he wanted to take a strong hand, or in Bolivia when the indigenous voted for an indigenous leader. In Venezuela, Chavez was a dominant figure unlike Venezuela had seen in decades, and he definitely had the personality, had the charisma, the communication skills, and the ambitions to assert really phenomenal power of generating, you know, a love-hate relationship with many people. So as Dan said, there was an incredible devotion of many people who felt like they were receiving for the first time the respect of a leader who also gave them voice and represented them and emphasized how he was like them, came from humble roots like them. And then there were those who felt excluded from his vision and from his government, who have been, you know, very strongly opposed to him and who felt like that they were losing their own lifestyle. And that's why the debate has been, as David said, almost an existential debate over people who felt like there were two directions for the country to go, and either one side would lose the essence of their lifestyle.
David Smiley, let's bring you back in on this. You've been following the civil society there and creating a democratic system of sorts that have been different from the historic democracy in Venezuela. How would you describe what it's become?
It's actually been a number of different phases throughout the Chavez government. As I mentioned before, Chavez came to power, and the real key metaphor for Chavez was participatory democracy. And this was the idea that if we could just get in all these civil society groups and social movements involved, that that would deepen democracy and that would create a more sensitive democracy, one that functions better and meets citizens' needs. Of course, the problem is when you actually try to have a governing project and you have this cacophony of voices, it can be very difficult to actually get anything done. By 2002 or so, Chavez clearly was moving to a much more centralizing logic to his governing project. And traditional civil society, you know, was largely excluded. In fact, in the period of 2002-2004, the opposition to the Chavez government often referred to itself as la sociedad civil. It was civil society. When there was a coup in 2002 that took Chavez out of power for 48 hours, at that moment it became really clear to the government that a lot, you know, the pro-government civil society groups, or community radio stations, pro-government social movements were very, very important to their survival. And so after that period, for a number of years, they really started supporting and founding all kinds of social movements and pro-government civil society groups. By 2006, that became a, you know, much more robust effort to try and really create and control these citizen participation through groups like communal councils, cooperatives, and now more recently communes. And so now we have this much more corporatist project in which the government has this idea, you know, the next sort of stage would be the communal state, has this idea that there will be articulation from the citizen all the way up to the executive branch through these different levels of participatory initiatives. So it's become something quite different than what it originally started as.
Jennifer McCoy, I believe you called it a hybrid democracy, sort of democratic, but had these authoritarian qualities. How would you describe this?
It's a big debate over how to characterize the democracy among a lot of observers, journalists, as well as scholars. Certainly, the electoral basis of the regime is clearly democratic. The new kinds of participatory mechanisms are a way to deepen the democracy and create more avenues of participation, what David was just describing. On the other hand, the sort of traditional liberal democracy approach that many people in the United States favor includes a strong emphasis on the separation of powers, independent branches of government. And that's what has become blurred in Venezuela, with the strength of the governing party basically controlling most of the branches of government and the democratic institutions. So many in the opposition in Venezuela feel like that they are not independent of political influence from the government, let's say the courts, the judicial system. There are questions about that. So that's where the debate lies, really, I'd say, on that liberal democracy vision versus the more participatory democracy vision that the Chavez movement has been trying to implement.
Daniel Levine, you tried to separate the idea of democracy from good governance or good results. How would you characterize Venezuela's quality of democracy?
Jose Molina and I published a paper recently in which we called it a democracy of low quality, but still a democracy. We were roasted in the place where we participated. People said, well, how much do you have to remove from democracy for one still to be able to call it a democracy? I'd just like to comment on some of the points that David and Jennifer made. First of all, this is the most centralized government and the most highly personalized government in easily 80 years or so. Chavez concentrated more power in himself than any president since Juan Vicente Gomez, and that's a lot. Secondly, as to the courts and the question of whether or not there's independence in the branches of government, the brute fact is that there is no independence in the courts. It's just a joke, really, to talk about it. There are elections, that's certainly true. There are significant questions about accountability of government officials and transparency. That basically is very little. And I wanted to comment briefly on the question of this so-called alternative project for participatory democracy. There's a lot of doubt about the actual independence of these groups and the extent to which they are civil society groups functioning from below, or whether they are mechanisms of control and transmission from above. The research that I've seen, and I've recently been reading a lot of stuff by Venezuelan scholars on this, indicates that, first of all, participation in many communal councils is very spotty, is highly tied to membership in or getting benefits from the government or the official party. And they're just not independent groups as we conceive of civil society. So if you're talking about it as an alternative form of participation, I think it's important to factor in that it's a form of participation which is highly structured and shaped from above. So there are significant problems of accountability, I think, and there are some questions about the relative autonomy of these civil society groups, particularly the communal councils and the other groups that they replaced in the future. Chavismo in its career has gone through lots of organizational vehicles. Communal councils are now what they're talking about. We'll see in the future whether they continue to restlessly create more vehicles or whether these acquire some life of their own, I have my own doubts about it.
David Smalley.
I think that, you know, that's exactly right. And I think you could actually go beyond that and say it's not that there's a real question about the autonomy of these groups. The government has a very explicit project that these groups should not be autonomous, that they should be part of this whole project that extends from the presidency all the way down through several levels, all the way to these projects. They're seen as something that should be part of this national project. They should be articulated with the national vision. Of course, it's an ideology that's it's very much a corporatist type ideology that goes back to, I think, a very different political culture, one that thinks of, you know, it's a more Republican type political culture in which we have to be the nation and, you know, morality comes from the collectivity and everything has to be part of one organism, this general will. And so I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's not much autonomy, and I think that the aim of the communal state is to erect a whole new geometry that really gets rid of the whole idea of autonomy because they don't really believe in it.
Jennifer McCoy, one other aspect of your research, which deals with the issue of corruption, you seem to have argued that addressing that is the core issue has been part of the problem. What is the situation?
In Venezuela, in part because of oil wealth, there has been always an issue with corruption, particularly as oil prices get high. And there's a lot of money to go around, and a lot of people benefit in positive ways and legal ways, but there's also a lot of opportunity for corruption. Venezuela has had in the past problems of corruption with exchange rate controls back in the 1980s, and similarly today. It's very hard to measure, to know what the levels are now versus the past, but I would just say it's a persistent problem in Venezuela. And the way to address it is to have accountability mechanisms, which gets back to one of Dan's points. You need transparency and accountability mechanisms. And there you do need to have oversight mechanisms, institutions that are independent sufficiently to be able to investigate and to hold, you know, to account the various branches of government, anybody that's controlling public funds, and transparency about budgets, about public spending, so that citizens can also hold their elected representatives and appointed officials accountable. It's been difficult to get some of that information to be able to really assess and for citizens to be able to, and journalists as well, I'd say media, to be able to investigate enough to know whether or not or how to hold their own government accountable. And then you also get to the question that Dan was discussing before about the courts and the other accountability mechanisms.
Let's turn now to the current state and what we see in the future. David Smalley, you started by talking about where the polls are pointing, suggesting that Chavez's successor is going to win in the upcoming election. Who are the candidates? What do we need to know about them? And what are going to be the issues that ultimately decide the election?
The candidate that was designated by Chavez is Nicolas Maduro, who was Chavez's foreign minister for the last 6 years. And Chavez in December made a very dramatic announcement that he was returning to Cuba for surgery and that if anything were to happen that he wanted Nicolas Maduro to be his political successor and he asked people to vote for him. Maduro himself is a person without Chavez's charisma. He comes from the left side of the spectrum within the Chavez government. He's a union negotiator, so he has a sort of pragmatic side. However, the core of his political ideology is anti-imperialism. He was foreign minister, so most of his rhetoric has to do with Venezuela in this world that's dominated by the United States and independence and autonomy and the nation, etc. His basic campaign has been to point to Chavez and mention Chavez's name as many times as possible because basically his strongest attribute in these elections is that he was designated by Chavez and has Chavez's blessing, and so that's why people will be supporting him. The opposition candidate is Enrique Capriles Radonsky. He was the opposition candidate in the October 2012 elections. Last year, he ran as a sort of can-do reconciler, you know, almost as sort of an uncandidate, you know, to try and show a different side or something different from Chavez, who was always politicizing everything and strongly ideological. That got him to 45%, which was the best showing of any candidate running against Chavez. And so that was a pretty good feat. This election in 4 weeks, and he's taken a very different path. I think it makes sense, a much more aggressive path. He's basically trying to separate the image of Maduro and Chavez and come out much more frontally against Maduro. Now, as far as issues, so far the campaign has been largely issue-free. Maduro doesn't address issues because basically his strongest card is the fact that Chavez designated him. Capriles isn't addressing issues. He's just taking Maduro on very frontally. I personally think that's a big mistake. I don't think he's going to win the election, but I think this would be a good moment for the opposition to really show what ideas they have for the problems that are affecting Venezuela and what ideas they have for the future of Venezuela. And who knows, that could maybe give him a boost in the polls, as Bill Clinton did in 1992 or Chavez himself in 1998, really came on and had really substantive messages about the issues, messages that people could understand. So far, the campaign has shaped up to be largely issue-free.
Now, Maduro has just recently also severed communication with the U.S., which seems like part of his statement, this anti-imperialist statement that he's making to his constituency, again, kind of feeding that good guys and bad guys framework. I assume that will go over well, but what does that say for the future of Venezuela in international relations? Jennifer McCoy?
They haven't severed all relations. The embassies are still open. We haven't had ambassadors in either country for a couple of years, but there's still contact through the rest of the staff at the embassies. What they said was they would suspend the recent contacts and conversations that had begun last fall, October elections, about having improved ties and beginning to discuss a new exchange of ambassadors. So they're putting that off for now. I expect that it could be renewed after the elections. As I think David said, the anti-imperialism message has always been a strong campaign message of Chavez and now of Maduro as well. It's also been part of the foreign policy goals of Chavez since he was elected to sort of change the balance of power in the world and create more of a multipolar balance of power rather than a unipolar world with the U.S. dominating both in this hemisphere and globally. And so that's been one of his ambitions for the last 14 years as well, is kind of a serious foreign policy vision. And then put on top of that campaign rhetoric, it's always good to rally around the flag and, you know, carry out a nationalist message is often, seen as politically favorable.
This is Daniel Levine. I'm not an economist, but as I've just been reading some economics papers, as I understand it, but the United States is still the single largest trading partner, although the balance is changing. One of their policies has been to get rid of investments that the National Oil Company had overseas. They're trying to shift the balance of their trade, but their trade with the United States is still quite important. I think that a break in relations, as both David and Jennifer said, is not, they both affirm that that is not really in the cards. I think this is more an electoral issue right now.
So it's really just rhetoric is what you're saying.
Well, it's always been a lot of rhetoric, but it's certainly true what Jennifer said, that Chavez from the beginning did want to reshape Venezuela's position in international affairs, and in imitation of his hero Bolivar, he was looking for a unification of Latin Americans in contrast to North Americans. But nonetheless, there is still an important relation with the United States, a cultural relation, an economic relation that does remain, although political relations are not very good. That's certainly true.
And so how do you see it shaping up now in the post-Chavez Venezuela in terms of the balance of power as Venezuela moves on to its next leader? He did do a lot to try to unite Latin America, and he also allied quite a bit with those that the United States would deem not such great friends, Iran and, you know, certainly Gaddafi when he was there.
Well, I can say something quickly about that. I think that if Maduro wins, seems likely, I think these policies will remain in force, although I think it's going to be much more difficult for Maduro to manage all the elements of that coalition. The Chavista coalition is heterogeneous. He doesn't have that personal force that was held together by Chavez, not by anybody else. And I think it'll be difficult. I think there are various possible scenarios for the future. One is a continuation of the current situation, which is a slow tightening of controls, attacks on independent elements in civil society, attempts to gather more, as David said, a more corporatist control model. Another one is more open participation by the military, who are the big institutional gainers of the last 20 years. The military has grown a great deal and has a great deal of presence in public administration. A third one, which preoccupies me very greatly, is endemic conflict. I mean, it is a very polarized society. And as everybody here has said, each side distrusts the other, sees the other as an existential threat. And what bothers me and what worries me is the possibility of low-grade to high-grade violence over the future between these sides. That has never been a feature of Venezuelan political history in the modern period, but it could happen. There's precedent in other countries for this, such as the long-term, low-grade hostility and violence between Peronistas and the military in Argentina. Anything's possible. I think the country has immense problems. Its infrastructure is falling apart. The inflation is high. Imports are very high. The currency is not in very good shape. They produce less petroleum, import more than they used to. Violence is a problem. Insecurity. There's a lot of problems, really concrete problems that any government will have to address within the country, and whether or not it will be able to do so before it goes out to pursue an aggressive foreign policy isn't very clear to me. I just don't know that they will have the ability to, he'll have the ability, whoever it is, to hold that coalition together effectively.
I wanted to get a sense of what the current mood on the ground points to. David Smiley, how you see the direction pointing from there in Caracas?
I could say just quickly that since Chavez died, that has been the overwhelming news. And the polls have shown that Maduro got a big boost from Chavez's passing and Chavez's own memory. And so that's been the overwhelming news. Chavez's positive numbers are about 68%. The negatives are less than 20%. So that's, I think, the overwhelming sense right now. There doesn't seem to be a lot of jubilation or, you know, real ferment in the streets. It seems to be kind of quiet these days. And, you know, everything points to a continuation of the Chavez project under the direction of Nicolas Maduro.
Well, we will see how that goes in a couple of weeks with the election as the starting point of the next era. Jennifer McCoy, Daniel Levine, David Smiley, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Daniel Levine is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Michigan and the author of The Quality of Democracy in Latin America. Jennifer McCoy is Professor of Political Science and Director of the Carter Center's Americas Program at Georgia State University. She is the author of International Mediation in Venezuela. David Smiley is a professor of sociology at the University of Georgia and co-editor of Participation, Politics, and Culture in Venezuelans and Bolivarian Democracy. That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Akhasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at armudian. We'll see you next week.